Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Civil Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, December 1st, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Today we welcome Roger B. Clegg. He's the president of and general counsel at the Center for Equal Opportunity. And hopefully in a few minutes we'll also have Professor Theodore M. Shaw, who's the Julius L. Chambers Distinguished Professor of Law and Director of the Center for Civil Rights at the University of North Carolina School of Law. So I think what we're going to do is turn it over to Mr. Clegg to sort of introduce the case here. Hopefully we'll get Professor Shaw as well to give some opening remarks, and then we will go to your questions. So Mr. Clegg, whenever you're ready, take it away.
Okay, well, thanks very much. And, you know, Ted Shaw and I are old sparring partners, so if for some reason he's not able to come through, maybe I'll just change my voice slightly and pretend that I'm him and nobody will be any the wiser. We're talking today about the case Abigail Fisher versus University of Texas at Austin. The Supreme Court, of course, has granted cert in this case, and oral argument is scheduled for a week from tomorrow, next Wednesday. The case involves a challenge to the use of racial and ethnic preferences in undergraduate admissions at the University of Texas. If you're feeling a sense of deja vu, that's because this is the case's second trip to the Supreme Court. In 2013, the court reversed a Fifth Circuit decision that had upheld the university's policy, saying that the lower court had been too deferential to the school, particularly with respect to applying the narrow tailoring prong of strict scrutiny. On remand, the Fifth Circuit again ruled for the university, and Ms. Fisher's lawyers again petitioned the court, and last summer the court granted the petition. What I'd like to do today is to divide the discussion into two parts. First, to talk a little bit about what the court is likely to do with the case, and then talk about what the court should do with the case. Needless to say, the court's review comes at an interesting time, as it turned out. The court didn't know it when it took the case, but with the numerous campus protests on race-related issues, that makes this kind of a particularly interesting case. Also of interest, I think, is the fact that Ms. Fisher's lawyers have now filed lawsuits against Harvard and Ted Shaw's school, I think, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And the lawsuit against Harvard in particular emphasized allegations of discrimination in admissions against Asian Americans, which is an issue that's becoming, I think, increasingly salient. So anyway, all in all, it's an interesting case and an exciting time to for the court to hear it. I said that the first thing I wanted to talk about a little bit is what the court is likely to do with the case. And I should begin by noting the important fact that Justice Kagan is recused, probably because of the fact that when she was Solicitor General, she approved the Justice Department's filing an amicus brief when the case was then before the Fifth Circuit for the first time. And I think the rules of recusal are that, you know, once you've been involved in the case in the administration, then you're not allowed to sit on a case when it comes before the court. So we're dealing with an 8-member court here. And I think that, you know, when you sort of go through the math, that probably means that the conservatives, you know, the four most conservative justices, probably feel fairly confident that they have 5 votes. That is, you know, Justice Kennedy will agree that the Fifth Circuit's decision needs to be reversed. It would be sort of odd for the court particularly for the conservatives, to grant review if they thought that the case was going to end up in a 4-4 deadlock, which would then just affirm the Fifth Circuit's decision, which was in favor of the University of Texas. So I'm hopeful that we're starting out at least with a pretty good chance of the University of Texas's policy being struck down. Now, of course, there are a variety of ways that the University of Texas's policy could be struck down. The court could write a very narrow decision. There are a lot of quirks in this particular case that would enable the court to write such a narrow decision. I mean, in particular, one of the most important facts is that the University of Texas had already achieved a high degree of racial and ethnic diversity because the Texas State Legislature had passed the so-called Top 10% Plan, which required the University of Texas to admit any student who was in the top 10% of his or her Texas public high school graduating class. So it's possible, for example, that the court could write a decision that said that, well, you know, in light of the fact that there was already a high degree of diversity because of the fact that there was this top 10% plan in place, therefore the University of Texas loses, and such an opinion would not tell us very much about what other universities could do. My hope is that they will go further than that. I think that it's going to be tempting for the court to flat out reverse the Fifth Circuit rather than to send it back yet again. The Fifth Circuit has already had two bites at the apple, and the Supreme Court didn't like the job that it had done the first time, and I'm hypothesizing that probably they're not going to like the job that they did this time either, that both times they were too deferential to the University of Texas. So I think that there's a good likelihood that the Supreme Court will, in a five-judge, five to three justice majority, will reverse the Fifth Circuit. There will be no remand. And then the question becomes, how broad a decision do they write? One thing that, unfortunately, I think will probably not happen, although it could, is that the Supreme Court will actually reverse its decision in the Grutter case that recognized diversity, the educational benefits of racially and ethnically diverse student body as a compelling benefit. I say that for a couple of reasons. Number one, the petitioners did not ask this time around for the court to reverse Grutter, which I think makes it less likely that the court will take that step. Another reason why that might be unlikely is that so far Justice Kennedy in the Grutter decision and in the earlier Fisher decision and also to some extent in a K-12 decision involving Seattle and Louisville a few years ago seems to be okay with diversity being a compelling interest, that he seems to be okay with recognizing that the first prong of strict scrutiny might be met in some cases. But what he's always criticized in those three cases has been the failure of the school to meet the narrow tailoring prong. So, you know, if I had to bet, I would bet that Justice Kennedy and a majority of the court would not reach the compelling interest prong and would instead simply describe in some detail why the University of Texas's use of race in admissions is not narrowly tailored. Now, that decision could be an extremely important one and could you know, depending on how broadly it was written, could make it could put real constraints on universities all over the country in their use of racial and ethnic preferences. I mean, for instance, if part of the narrow tailoring inquiry was going to be that the school had to describe precisely what the educational benefits are that it wants to achieve for its particular student body and how they are compelling. And if then they had to go further and say how exactly it is that there is no way to achieve these particular educational benefits except by using racial and ethnic preferences in admissions, the court were to write a decision like that and really to lay out pretty strict constraints, then I think that that would be almost as good as a victory. It's also possible, though, that, you know, Justice Kennedy might decide that, well, you know, it's obvious that universities are just not getting the message. You know, I want them to consider race as basically just a tiebreaker, just something that's given a little bit of weight. That was what Justice Powell had in mind in Bakke. That's what I think Justice Connor might have had in mind in Grutter. That's what I have in mind in this case. The universities just are not acting in good faith, and there's a lot of evidence of that lack of good faith, which I can talk about in more detail later. And so Justice Kennedy might say, well, you know, the only way that I'm going to be able to get schools to consider race just a little bit, you know, in a non-mechanical way, is if I tell them that they can't use race at all. And if I do that, they're probably still going to cheat. Race will still find its way into the equation in individual admissions decisions. But if I don't ban them from taking race into account, then they are going to continue to use it in the mechanical, heavy-handed way that they have been ever since Bakke. So therefore, the only way to get to where I want to go from where we are, given the way that universities operate, is for me to overturn Grutter and to say that you can't consider race at all. So that's also a possibility, and that's what I'm hoping for. Have we found Professor Shaw, or is Professor Shaw called in, Tim?
He's not on the line just yet, no.
Okay.
So
Professor Shaw's fault, by the way. I should make it clear. This is we've had some technical problems here. I'm sure Professor Shaw is not at fault with this, and I do apologize. Well, Tim, would you like me to talk a little bit more about the case, or should we start accepting calls from some of the listeners?
Why don't we go right into questions, and then if we have some time when that's over, we can let you finish up your remarks. How does that sound?
That sounds good. Let me make one point. Just this is sort of on the other side, and I feel obliged to make it since Ted is not here. There is an issue that's been raised repeatedly in this case about whether Ms. Fisher has standing and also whether the case is moot. This is something that the university has stressed all along. Ms. Fisher, of course, has long since, was admitted instead and went to LSU, and she's graduated. And so there are some standing and mootness issues that the university has raised. I rather doubt that the court is going to get hung up on that, or at least I don't think that a majority of the court will get hung up on that. As I say, these issues were raised and emphasized when the university was trying to keep the case from the Supreme Court the first time around. It was then briefed again on the merits, you know, these standing and mootness issues, and then they were briefed again when the petitioners petitioned this time around. Each time, the court seemed to conclude that, well, no, we do have a case or controversy here, and it went on and handled the case on the merits. So while that's something that might play a role in the court's ultimate decision, and it's certainly something that the University of Texas is pushing for, my own guess is that will not be a factor.
Well, I have some good news. I think Professor Shaw has just dialed in on the call. Professor Shaw, are you there?
I am, and I apologize so much. I was trying to get a petition in, and somebody was incarcerated, and was so focused on a conversation I was having with co-counsel that I lost track of time. So I apologize.
Well, we're certainly glad to have you now.
Ed, so you know you've made a liar out of me, but that's okay.
I would never want to do that, so I beg forgiveness.
No, that's fine. Well, listen, Ted, let me just tell you sort of what I've done, and then, you know, you can leap in. I don't know at what point you started to listen. I just gave a little bit of background about the case. I talked about what I thought the court probably would do in terms of, you know, how the justices were likely to vote and all that kind of thing. But then I went on and I talked about what I thought that they should do, that, you know, I am hopeful that they'll write a pretty robust opinion that really puts teeth into the narrow tailoring inquiry. I did not give your side of the argument because I figured that you would do that much better, although I did point out that the school is continuing to challenge or continue to raise standing and mootness issues for Ms. Fisher. But with those caveats, feel free to hold forth.
Well, thank you, and you know and thank you for that. I think that there remains some substantial questions with respect to mootness and standing, but those existed, they were there before. The court's well familiar with those issues, and it hasn't derailed consideration of the case. So however strongly I may feel about the merits of those issues, you know, it doesn't appear like it's going to be decided on those grounds unless they decide at this late moment that they want an out. That's what I would add on that point. Now, I have thought, and my esteemed colleague will, without question, take issue with this, and this is one of the things that maybe we can kind of meet on and debate. But I have thought that Fisher and the court's last consideration of Fisher really didn't add a significant change to the law, because I can characterize it as saying strict scrutiny, and we mean it. But strict scrutiny should always have been weighty and strict. And so I'm not sure how much was being added here with respect to a change in the law, though, you know, I don't expect that there's going to be agreement on this. All that is to say that as a civil rights lawyer who's litigated these kinds of cases and these kinds of issues, I, for one, but also I believe our colleagues, certainly when I was at the Legal Defense Fund, we always understood strict scrutiny to be exactly what it said it was, which is demanding, it's vigorous, it does require meeting a standard that is not an easy one to meet. The thing is that the court has said now in Grutter, and it was debatable about whether Bakke actually constituted an opinion on the part of the court with respect to diversity, but it operated as if it did for many, many years. So the court has said for quite some time now that diversity is a compelling state interest. At least since Grutter, any debate about that has been put to rest. And so what we really get into is a narrow tailoring discourse, I believe. And the question of whether the University of Texas has engaged in narrow tailoring and whether it has considered race-neutral or other alternatives, and the degree to which those alternatives have to be considered and when, under what circumstances, all of those could be in play. I get that. I understand that. And I think that's probably going to be the court's focus. Now, my own view is that in some ways the University of Texas is, from the standpoint of those who advocate diversity measures, as I do, and as the universities are free to pursue, the University of Texas case is not, I think, the best vehicle for the court to revisit if it feels compelled to revisit its earlier decisions on this issue, most notably Grutter. Because in Texas you have this kind of wild card 10% plan with a kind of post 10% operation of Grutter considerations for those who are not admitted pursuant to the Texas plan. That's not in any real sense what most universities, colleges, and graduate and professional schools, that's not the scenarios that they're pursuing. And so I think it's rather unfortunate that the court is considering a revisitation of its decision in Grutter, if that's what it's doing, as opposed to something more narrow in this case, which is atypical. In any event, I don't think it needs to reach that issue. If anything, it could dispose of the case if it feels compelled to address it on the merits by an opinion which says under these facts, in this case, with its unusual factual presentation, it's not necessary for UT to do what it is doing to achieve diversity. But that's not to say that I think that UT doesn't advance and can't advance arguments that constitutionally justify its pursuit of diversity in the remaining non-10% seats. I think it can. I think it does. So maybe I should stop there and then we should join issues.
Yeah, that's fine. And Tim, if it's okay, I'd like just to briefly respond to what Ted has said, and then if I say anything really outrageous, then Ted can respond to that, and then we can go to questions. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that sounds great.
Okay. Well, Ted, I think was I there said some things that I actually agree with. I think that while I don't think that. I think that Fisher did, the first Fisher decision did add something to the mix. It certainly didn't add as much as I would have liked. I think a lot of people on both sides of the aisle, you know, read the decision when it came down and thought, gee, you know, for this we've waited. I mean, I think that the decision did not come down until the last day of the term, and there was, you know, this great anticipation, and then this nearly unanimous decision came down. I think it was 7-1 with only Justice Ginsburg dissenting. And, you know, it was a very short opinion. It was 12 pages, and I think that Ted is right that the theme of it, if you had to summarize it, was that, you know, strict scrutiny means strict, especially on the narrow tailoring prong. You know, Justice Kennedy went out of his way to say that, look, you know, there may have been a lot of discussion in Grutter about deference, but that's really deference only on the first prong of strict scrutiny, not the second prong. And then I think there is some helpful language in there on, you know, what narrow tailoring means. There was a lot of speculation that, and I think a Joan Biskupic wrote a book that said that originally Kennedy had written a bolder opinion, but that he was intimidated into retracting that because of this stinging dissent that Sotomayor had written. I don't know whether that's true or not. And of course, ultimately, she may have recycled that dissent the next year in the Schuette case. But anyway, I also agree with Ted that this may well not be the vehicle for revisiting Grutter, if for no other reason, as I said earlier, that the petitioners have not actually asked for that. I don't think that the reason for it being an inappropriate vehicle, though, is because of the top 10% plan. I mean, I think that if the court wanted to revisit whether the educational benefits, alleged educational benefits of a diverse student body are compelling or not, it could do it in this case if it wanted to. And the fact that there are these additional narrow tailoring problems because of the top 10% plan wouldn't stop them from doing that. I guess for the listeners, we should talk a little bit about what the narrow tailoring dispute is about now. And just briefly, you know, the question is whether, in light of the fact that you had this top 10% plan out there that was resulted in actually a higher percentage of African Americans and Latinos than before the University of Texas had, or when the University of Texas was actually using racial and ethnic preferences in the mid-1990s, whether they are justified in reinstating racial and ethnic preferences now. And that's what a lot of the back and forth in the briefs is about. Originally, the University of Texas said that, well, there's not enough classroom diversity. You know, classroom by classroom diversity. There's still a lot of individual classes that don't have the critical mass of students that we want. And they also pointed to the changing demographics in the general population of the state. They're not emphasizing that so much now. Now the emphasis is more on the fact that the African Americans who are, in particular, who are admitted under the top 10% plan tend to come from lower socioeconomic backgrounds than the African Americans that they are trying to admit through the use of racial and ethnic preferences. And that, and when you think about it, that kind of makes sense. The reason that the top 10% plan results in some diversity in the University of Texas is because there is a lot of residential segregation, you know, de facto segregation. And so, therefore, the individuals who go to those schools probably don't have as much money as the African Americans who live in middle class and well-to-do neighborhoods, but those African Americans go to schools where they may not be graduating in the top 10% of the class. And so anyway, the University of Texas's argument is that, you know, we want to have diversity within diversity. We don't want to just, you know, be admitting poor African Americans. We want to be admitting some middle and upper class African Americans as well. And the University of Texas has also pointed to the problem of, that they see of racial isolation in some aspects of campus life. So, you know, the question is whether those kinds of things are, you know, show that race-neutral alternatives have been have failed or not. And I think that will be part of the focus at oral argument. It was a big part of the focus at oral argument last time around when the court heard this case. Ted, did you want to respond to any of those outrageous lies before we turn it up to the question?
You know, Roger, first, you and I have known each other for a long, long time. And as you indicated, we probably can give each other's arguments. We know them so well. There was nothing outrageous there, just things about which we have some different views. And one of the things I want to hone in on, you know, Roger's absolutely correct that the court last time around spent some time in some exchanges about what really lies at the heart of the University of Texas diversity plan. And there was this interesting exchange between counsel for the University of Texas and Justice Alito, in which Justice Alito said, I don't have it before me, I should, but he said words to this effect, and Raj, I invite you to, you know, to hold me to accuracy on this if you disagree, but in effect, what he said was, listen, I'm a little confused because I thought this was all about trying to admit disadvantaged minority students, and now you're telling me that the son or the daughter who's African-American, of a doctor or a lawyer, that they ought to also be beneficiaries of diversity efforts or admitted pursuant to diversity plans. And I thought that was a very interesting exchange. I would have responded to it a little bit differently than counsel for the University of Texas, because that goes to the core of what the court's jurisprudence in this area has done. The court, through the remedial rationale for race-conscious admissions under the bus in Bakke in 1978, Justice Alito's question, I think perhaps unbeknownst to him, reflected, I think, some confusion about what the court is trying to do. Because, in fact, the African-American son or daughter of a doctor or a lawyer who might be better off financially still brings some diversity to the university, and the argument that the university has made in part is that it doesn't want its students to have the impression that all black students are poor, all black students are anything. There's diversity among black students as there are among all students. And so if the court, in fact, embraced diversity as the rationale, the surviving rationale, in effect, even though I would make a strong argument, if we had the time, for undoing what the court did with respect to the remedial rationale in Bakke. But if the court has adopted the diversity rationale, then it has to live with it, and living with it includes exactly what Justice Alito seemed to be struggling with. I do think that's probably going to be, or should be, properly part of the discourse in the court when it hears this argument. I think that there's still confusion, even among some of the justices, on exactly what the diversity rationale is and what it allows. I also would underscore, I think Roger's absolutely right about the 10% plan, how it works and why, and what it does and does not do. And I also think he's correct to point to the changing demographics in the state of Texas, which may ultimately mean that Latino students, Chicano students, may end up, in some significant numbers at UT because the demographics are that significant. But I don't know if it's going to work as well for African American students. So much more that can be said, but I'll stop there.
Okay, we have about 20 minutes left with our speakers, so I think we're going to go ahead and move into audience questions, if that's okay. So I'm going to open the floor to questions now. In a moment, we're all going to hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key on your telephone. When we get to your request, you'll hear a prompt, and then you can ask your question. So while we wait for some questions to queue up, our lines are wide open right now. Let me make a couple of quick programming notes. Our next scheduled Teleform conference call is going to be this Friday at a time yet to be determined. We're going to have a conversation with Adam White of Boyd & Gray & Associates about U.S. Telecom Association versus FCC, a lawsuit challenging the FCC's net neutrality rules. The Teleform will take place shortly after the D.C. Circuit's Friday morning oral argument. We will let you all know just as soon as we know when that Teleform is going to be, but as always, our full schedule is available at fedsoc.org. And if you happen to miss the Teleform, don't worry, they all go up as podcasts on our website. And with that, we will move to the first audience question.
Hello, this is Jerry Hunter in St. Louis, and I wanted to ask Roger a question. Roger, in your opening statements, remarks, you indicated, and you can correct me if I misunderstood you, but I thought you indicated you were hoping for a very broad ruling by the court. And I want to ask you, I know in many cases, and I sort of get upset with judges when they decide questions not before them, normally conservatives are generally happier with narrow rulings by the courts. Do you see anything inconsistent with your statement and what I believe there may be some exceptions to it where conservatives normally prefer a narrow ruling by the court?
Well, that's a very good question. Thank you, Jerry. And no, you didn't misquote me or anything like that. I guess there are a couple of things that, in my view, make it appropriate for the court to rule broadly in this case. The first point is that ruling broadly is necessary if the court is to clean up the mess that it has made. The only reason that we are talking about the constitutionality of racial preferences is because a majority of the court, unfortunately, in 1978 in the Bakke case, ignored the plain language of Title VI of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. That statute says, no person in the United States shall, on the ground of race, color, or national origin, be subjected to discrimination under any program or activity receiving federal financial assistance, end quote. There's no question that Abigail Fisher and Alan Bakke and Jennifer Gratz and Barbara Grutter were all treated differently because of their race. By a university that got federal funding. Unfortunately, the court said that it was not going to follow the plain language of that statute, and instead it was going to treat it as if it were coextensive with the Equal Protection Clause. So a broad ruling saying that, well, no, we're not going to accept the diversity rationale would really be just taking us back to where we should have been in 1978. I also think that putting Title VI aside, there's two kinds of judicial activism. There's making stuff up that isn't in the Constitution because you wish it were there as a policy matter. But there's also ignoring stuff that is in the Constitution because you wish it weren't there as a policy matter. And one thing that the framers of the 14th Amendment wanted, and which is, I think, extremely important for the United States, particularly as we become more and more a multi-ethnic and multiracial country, is a legal regime where people are not sorted according to skin color and what country their ancestors came from, and treated differently. That's what the Constitution says. That's what I think our country has to have in 2015, and that is something that the court needs to make clear. It needs to take some of these issues off the table because they really should not be part of the political process. You know, some things shouldn't be part of the political process. You know, we don't decide who gets to publish newspapers by vote, and I think that we shouldn't be leaving racial discrimination to a vote either.
So, if I can step in and say a few things and respond to any reaction. The court now has wrestled with the question of whether or not universities and colleges can consciously do something to admit students from groups that historically have been excluded ever since 1978. Actually, the first case that raised this issue, the court ducked in 74, as Roger knows. But since 1978, when we talk about judicial activism, the charge gets thrown around depending on whose ox is being gored. That's no less true here. The decision that the court made in Grutter is and should be entitled to being respected as settled law, but some folks are just not happy with it. Now, the characterization of what's at stake, with all due respect, Roger, sounds as if the court in 1978 began to write on a clean slate when it came to issues of race, and the court was less than 10 years out, really, from the end of the era of de jure segregation in this country. I say de jure segregation because although Brown was decided in 1954, it wasn't implemented to the extent it was until the 70s, but other forms of legalized segregation were intact until the end of the 1960s. So it didn't write on a clean slate. We still have this tremendous legacy and huge amounts of inequality. Nobody is looking at Abigail Fisher, or nobody looked at Ms. Grutter, or for that matter, Alan Bakke, who in fact was admitted to the medical school after the Bakke case as a consequence of litigation. But nobody's looking at them and saying that they're white, and we are excluding them. That's not what's going on with these students. The question is whether or not any incidental effect that they might feel, and it's questionable, as a consequence of courts deciding to allow universities to consider diversity, is acceptable and constitutional. It is not a matter of intentional discrimination against people because they are white. That's nonsense. So, with all due respect, this is still very much a question that the courts have wrestled with, and there are those who don't like what the courts have decided, and they keep coming back, and they're seeking another result. It is very different from what conservatives say they believe in, but I understand that it's a question of who perceives their oxes to be gored. Well, oxen, I should say.
Well, just
we do have another question on the line that we can move to. Probably have time for one more, maybe two quick questions. So with that, we're going to move to the next caller on the floor.
Okay.
This is Antoinette. Does it matter if the petitioner exercises his or her privilege earlier or later?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
Yeah, neither did I.
I said, does it matter if the petitioner, from the Supreme Court, does it matter whether or not, or on the Supreme Court, does it matter whether or not they access their privilege earlier or later, to avail themselves of the privileges of the pretext or plus factor of affirmative action at a university or as a state arm or state function of the law? I'm sorry, is that clear what I'm saying?
I don't know if Ted, if it's clear to you, then feel free.
It's
but
not,
I'm not sure I understood the question.
I'm sorry, and neither do I. You and I are in agreement.
Okay, so if it's an African American woman or a black woman who says that she wants to attend, say, a law school. And she may or may not have the test scores. Does it matter if, say, this person is now white, as in Fisher, and does it matter if she decided to attend school for the purposes of diversity? And she accessed her privilege later, would she still create or provide a valuable contribution on the substance of the matter, or would it be denied on the grounds of maybe a procedural or policy consideration if she didn't make, an argument consistent with the Constitution? It's so layered because there are three cases. And I guess one was decided on the grounds of, the policy argument for the university versus standing or mootness at the Supreme Court level versus the substance of whether or not it's based on race being a pretext or plus factor to preserve diversity. So that's why I'm running all the questions together, but because you all have been on the line so long, I'm sure you can tease it out. I'm just trying to figure out how you think the court will decide the case.
Okay. Well, let me address a couple of things in that, and then Ted, feel free to follow up. I think that the decision about whether the individual will add diversity or not is made by the university. Certainly the applicant in the application can stress the diversity that he or she thinks she will add, and can say that, I may be white, but I can, bring the following, unique experiences to the table. I should say that, one of the reasons why there is sometimes some, overlap in the diversity rationale and the remedial rationale is that the diversity rationale is looking for differences in background and perspectives, among individuals. And, perhaps what Justice Alito at oral argument, Ted, was, alluding to was that, well, if an African American has the same background as a non-African American, then what sense does it make to admit that person on grounds of diversity? And I understand that there may be, that there are answers to that, but that might have been what he was alluding to.
Well, I think we have to dig a little bit more deeply on that one, because an African American from a middle class or even an upper middle class family still has experiences as an African American, although they don't have the experiences of being poor. The question, though, was I'm not sure I ever got the crux of it, except that to the extent that I understood the question in part to go to people's how people think about these issues as they apply. I think people may be aware of the university's pursuit of diversity when they apply, but their motivation when they apply is to get in. You know, is to be a student admitted to that university, no matter what their background was. They may be conscious that they may bring different things to the application process, and that's what the court has said a university can consider. I don't think we live in a world where the people who are applying, however, are intending to see results or create results that are discriminatory against anyone else. They don't control the admissions process anyway. They're just trying to get in, and that may be true of people of color, but it also is true of white applicants. In an ideal world, the university would be considering all aspects of applicants, but that's about as far as I can respond, because I still didn't quite understand the rest of the question, and I gather, Roger, that you didn't either so much.
Tim, do we have time for another question?
I do.
I think we have a few minutes for one last question. Again, if you'd like to ask a question, enter star and then the pound key on your telephone. As of right now, our lines are wide open, so if anyone wants to... All right, it looks like we will indeed get to the one final question. Go ahead, caller.
Hi, this is a question for Professor Shaw. There's a great deal of discussion about underrepresented and overrepresented groups and people being from those groups. If the court is not to accept proportional representation as the standard for diversity, what do you think would be the appropriate percentages or numbers that would be defensible under narrow tailoring for a university to seek to achieve?
Well, I mean, you're going to part of the crux of what's been argued and maybe argued some more in Fisher. You know, proportionate representation is not the standard. And in fact, as you probably know, anything that smacks of quotas, and this is true even in Bakke and is still true under Grutter and Fisher for that matter, would be unconstitutional. The struggle is about at what point does a university say it wants to consciously attempt to take actions that are going to admit more students of color. You know, this whole idea of students being isolated because there isn't a critical mass of students of color, and so they're isolated in the classroom. Those are difficult issues. I acknowledge they're difficult issues. The expert testimony that has tried to address those issues, but I don't know that anybody has been completely satisfied with the answers there. My answer is imperfect. It is that I think institutions ought to be able to consider the fact that there are some groups that historically have been discriminated against, and they're not there in many numbers. The university thinks that bringing more students from those groups would contribute to the classroom environment and also reduce the isolation that students from that group might feel. Native Americans, vastly and horribly underrepresented in selective institutions of higher education. Should institutions be able to consciously attempt to admit Native American students while considering that they are Native Americans? My answer is I think yes. I don't think that's discriminatory against other students. Is there a number that should be applied? No. because that's third rail stuff. And so I would stay away from it as a matter of judicial counsel, but also in terms of what is right, I think I would stay away from it.
Well, that's just about all the time we have with our speakers today. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I'd like to thank Roger Clegg and Professor Shaw for joining us. Thanks also to everyone who is on the line. Once again, the next Teleforum is scheduled for this Friday, December 4th, at a time to be determined. We'll let you know as soon as that is. We hope you all can join us. And until then, thanks once again to Mr. Clegg and Professor Shaw. And so long for just a while.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.